Put the cat out, Mom. It's time for another SavtaCast. I'm your host, Scott C., and if it makes you happy, then why the hell are you so sad? Folks, let's get right into it right away because we got a great episode for you, and I don't want to waste much time gibbering and jabbering before we get into it. Right now, let me tell you a little bit about the SAFTA Reading Series, which is coming back to Knoxville. Not that it has ever gone anywhere but Knoxville, but I thought I'd just say that because it's a nice phrase, you know. Back in Knoxville on September 7th, that is a Sunday afternoon at 3 p.m., once again at the Birdhouse in Knoxville, Tennessee. This time out, the featured readers are Kentucky poets Matthew Houghton and Eric Scott Sutherland. Both of these guys are high energy. They are comedic, and they've got some great pieces. Folks, if you have never been to the Birdhouse in Knoxville, Tennessee, if you have never been to the award-winning SAFTA Reading Series, then you need to go to it. If you're in the Knoxville area and you're checking this out, you need to check it out, because it is worth your time. It seriously is. Now today we have a great show for you with Donna Voyer on the program here, and we had a great conversation. As you will see, as always on this AfterCast, the topics are diversified. We get into, as you'll hear, we get into talking about vacation and, you know, the travel, the trials and tribulations of eating while on global travel. We also talk about a whole bunch of things like collectibles, cartoons, you know, the power of good literature. It's just a great time, folks, and Donna is just such an awesome person. It was a real joy and a pleasure to have her on this program. Speaking of this program, folks, you may be aware that we are on iTunes and Twitter, and I encourage you to look us up there. Now, if you go on iTunes, if you enjoy this program, please rate us, review us. We'll shout your name on the beaches in Florida. We'll just run out to the beach and shout your name if you review us on there, okay? How about that? We'll do that. I'll make a deal with you. You do it. I don't care what your name is. Even if it's like SwimFan93, I will go out and yell on the beach, SwimFan93 is awesome! Even if it's a negative review. Just go to iTunes. Give us a review, rate us, and I'll let you compose some thoughts of what you might actually say while you listen to a wee bit of theme song.
Hey, Scott.
Hey, Donna. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. Pretty good indeed. So, right off the bat, I got the burning question that is on everybody's mind.
Yes.
What was your favorite breakfast cereal as a child?
Oh, that's easy. Captain Crunch.
Really?
Yes. Our parents let us eat the sugar stuff. You know, we didn't... I'm a lot older than many of the other poets you've talked to, and nobody was worried too much about... feeding your children organic food and such back then. It was feeding them what they would eat. And we were big Captain Crunch fans.
What was the appeal of Captain Crunch?
I don't know. I think partially the way the milk tastes when you're done eating it.
Ooh.
It's like caramely. It's very strange. Once in a while, as an adult, I will buy a box of Captain Crunch when I'm feeling particularly nostalgic. But most of the time, I am more wary about my cholesterol and stick with Cheerios and red berries and such.
Well, I'll give you a tip about Captain Crunch.
Yes.
Use it as an ice cream topping.
Ooh, that's a good idea.
I had that at a Sunday bar about 2 years ago, and I was like, this is the most brilliant thing on the planet.
I like that. I have to remember that, although the ice cream, not often in the house anymore either, but unfortunately. But that's a great idea.
Yeah, no, just treat yourself sometime. Get a bowl of ice cream, throw some Captain Crunch on top.
That sounds like a plan. I think that will be something I look into in the future.
Don't use the crunch berries or anything like that. Just standard fare.
No. Crunch berries don't count. Just regular old Captain Crunch.
They were illegal, I think, the crunch berry thing, in my opinion.
Wasn't ever a fan of any cereal that had a spinoff. With the exception of Honey Nut Cheerios.
Fair enough.
Otherwise, the original all the way.
Oh, I agree. I agree completely. No, my parents were okay with the sugar cereals as well. It didn't screw me up too bad.
If something screwed me up, it certainly wasn't Captain Crunch.
Exactly.
Or any novelty cereals, like when I'm a kid, you know, oh, Ghostbusters has a cereal. I've got to try Ghostbusters cereal now.
Yeah, I think they've kind of stopped that. I think it's more the, and I haven't seen too many tie-in cereals, although I don't spend too much time in the cereal aisle these days since my son doesn't live at home anymore, but I haven't seen too many of those kinds of toys, but not the actual cereals.
The toys have gotten bad, too. Now it's, they don't include toys really anymore. It's like, Cheerios still runs, here's a children's book shrunk down mini size for families, and here are movie tickets that you can get. But there's no, you know, here's a sinking submarine that you can put in your bathtub and use baking soda.
I was thinking that a lot of, you must mail in for something kinds of offers, I think, that I remember seeing even when my son was little, like, save this many things and you can get a stick so that you can freeze your Pop-Tarts or whatever the promotion happened to be. Pop-Tarts are a good thing too.
Oh, I agree. Occasionally, even as a 30-some-year-old, I will bust out the Pop-Tarts if they're on sale and be like, ooh, I haven't had Pop-Tarts in a while.
Pop-Tarts are great to put in your suitcase if you are traveling somewhere where you're not sure what you're going to eat.
Or when you're going to eat.
Yes. Because they are, you know, they're certainly not nutritious, but they are enough to fill you up.
And they're comforting.
Yes, they're familiar.
They're familiar. They're not like, okay, you know, I get into my 30s and suddenly my travel case now has Clif Bars in it.
Yeah, I think that's the case for a lot of people now. I think part of it, too, is this, well, I don't know. We travel quite a bit. We'd like to get back to it, actually. We did more when our son was little, surprisingly. And are not big fans of going somewhere and then having a homogenized food experience. You know, like, don't take me somewhere and then, because I'm a tourist, take me and feed me a hamburger. And I think that we often carry our own supplies, like, just in case. Just in case what we're eating isn't going to be palatable to us or what we're used to.
What if it's a really good hamburger, though? Like a local delicacy, almost.
I'm talking about, like, internationally.
Oh, okay.
So, like, when we were young and first traveling, I think only once we traveled, like, with a tour group, and we were like, mm-mm.
Not again.
Because every place you stopped for a meal, it was like they'd shuttle you into some banquet room where they would then feed you what they thought Americans wanted to eat. And so we very quickly would be ditching those meals and eating off of food carts and things, because what's the point of traveling somewhere if you're going to kind of remove yourself from the culture, and food is such a big part of that.
No, I totally agree. I mean, why would I go, if I'm going to New York City, I am not going to go to an Applebee's or a Chili's.
Exactly. Hopefully you're not.
No.
I would be sad if you did.
And if I'm going there, I'm usually visiting natives, and they agree. They would be like, no, we're going down on Houston Street. There's a great little cafe restaurant here. They serve the best freaking cannolis you will ever have.
Yeah, you're going to go with what the people in the area tell you to do, and you're going to trust it.
I trust it completely. I learned that from Anthony Bourdain, is that some of the best food in the world is street food.
Absolutely. And it's an interesting experience to have someone who lives in the place and just completely put yourself in their hands and go, where should we go eat? And that's when you end up having, you know, some of your most amazing experiences. We were talking about this the other day, actually, with everything that's, not to be a downer, but with everything that's going on with Jerusalem and Gaza. We visited that area of the world with our son when he was about 5. And when we were in Jerusalem, the person that we met that was kind of driving us around, so do you like falafel? Absolutely. Oh, well, to get the good falafel, we have to go on the Palestinian side and go through the checkpoints and everything. We were like, we don't care. And so we were sitting there eating this delicious falafel, and all of a sudden the restaurant owner got up and started closing all the windows that were open in the front of the restaurant. And you know, we were like, what are you doing? And he just points out the window very nonchalantly and goes, ah, tear gas down the street. So even when that place is not specifically on the news as being contentious, it's just a sad thing to think about, that even when you're going to have your lunch and eat your falafel, you have to worry about what might be happening down the road. So those kinds of experiences are interesting from lots of different cultural perspectives.
Exactly. You still have a great story out of it now.
Absolutely. Oh, we've got great stories from traveling. When we were in Spain, we were just looking for some little dive that was serving paella because it's not an everyday dish in most restaurants. And we finally found one, and there was almost nobody in there, which is usually not a good sign. We were like, whatever. And as we were having our meal, some guy walked in, sat down at the counter, and he had like a brown paper bag. And all of a sudden, he pulled out a pistol and some ammunition. And I knew enough Spanish to know that he was talking to the person at the counter about selling him the gun. But it was just a very strange experience to be sitting and eating dinner with someone pulling a pistol out of a brown paper bag 10 feet away from you.
And not like America, where they pull the pistol out and start waving it around, you know. No,
Very casually, having a nice conversation about whether or not the gentleman on the other side of the counter wanted to purchase the pistol. And
I got this beautiful pistol. Would you like pistol? You know, America would be like, I got a gun. Yeah. Look at it. Ain't it pretty?
It's like that. What's that it's movie with James Franco, Spring Breakers?
Oh, yeah.
And he's like, all the guns, and he's, this my shit, this all my shit. That's what I think of anytime anybody starts waving guns around like that, with that bravado.
So you guys, you do a lot of travel. You said you don't do as much traveling now, but where are some of the best places you've ever gone?
Oh, some of my favorite places that we've been, I would say if I had to pick favorites, which is very hard. Places I would like to go back to, let's put it that way.
Okay.
I don't go to too many places twice. I would love to go back to Cambodia, and I would love to go back to, let's say Cambodia would be number one on my list, but we've been to Europe, several cities in Europe, but we almost always have gone in the winter because I am a middle school teacher and I get a 2-week winter break. Mm-hmm. And, the winter is less expensive, obviously, to travel.
Off season.
Yeah. And so there are some cities in Europe that I would love to see in the summer or in the spring, like Vienna, I think is a beautiful city. And I loved Budapest and Prague. But if I had to pick one place to go back to, for sure, it would be Cambodia.
Why Cambodia?
Probably the most amazing people I've met in my travels have been there, simply in terms of the joy with which they live in the face of basically an entire generation of their people being wiped out, you know, by the Khmer Rouge, and seeing the kind of the intersection of history, of that violent history, by visiting places like, you know, the Killing Fields and Tuol Sleng prison, and ancient history, those Angkor Wat temples, and then the struggle for modernization to kind of come back as they're still rebuilding after all of the loss. I think just those three things together made it a really special place to be. And they said wonderful conversations with people there, and probably some of the most open and friendly people that we've met anywhere in the world. And we were only there for a short time because it was part of a long trip that we did. So that would definitely be a place to go back to.
I've seen, you know, I've never been really outside of the country at all, unfortunately. Just that's the way my life has gone. But, you know, I've seen places like Vietnam and Cambodia, and I can't even begin to imagine the beauty of the landscape there.
They're stunningly beautiful. It's almost unbelievable. And again, I think it's because that beauty is so juxtaposed with what we know about the violent histories of those countries, it makes it even more beautiful. Like, people live in this place that's like a visual paradise, and yet underneath all that is a lot of red is running underneath all of that.
And the scars have not healed in a lot of places. Right.
It was very strange to be in Vietnam at the, not the, what we would call the Vietnam War Museum, but the War of American Atrocities museum as Americans.
Hmm.
It was just to see that conflict, which is, you know, portrayed here. It was so divisive and controversial here, portrayed completely from the other side of the coin, was very, very interesting.
I could relate a little bit here in, you know, here in the United States and everything. I know from living up north and then moving to the South and such, there are some pockets of the South that still call the Civil War the War of Northern Aggression.
Mm-hmm.
And the scars have still not healed 150 some years later.
I think any kind of conflict. I wonder, it makes me wonder in the United States why that would still linger as much, I guess, because the conflict was, it was one of values, which most wars are, but, so we think generationally that maybe people would ease out of that. I don't know. I don't have a lot of experience with the Southern United States, although, I guess, I don't know if Nashville is considered South. That's where my son has chosen to live.
Technically, Tennessee is the South. Yes.
Yes. He says y'all now after being down there for 4 years, which just blows my mind. It's very strange to see your child who was raised in the Midwest start saying y'all.
No, my parents had to deal with it too. I lived in Mississippi for 2 years, and by the end of those 2 years, I am saying y'all.
Well, I think that's obviously you picked that out. It just makes me laugh. You know, at least it's better than the traditional Chicago, you know, gangster accent, which my father had a little bit of when we were kids and would really get on us if he heard some of that coming out in us. Any use, you know, like use guys.
Hey, use guys.
Yeah, or any of that kind of stuff was promptly greeted with, you should not speak that way. Okay.
Why was Dan insisting on that?
I think it was more because neither one of my parents went to college, and I think that my dad, having grown up on the South Side of Chicago, kind of had that and worked hard to get rid of it because he was in sales for most of my childhood, and knew that accent, that inflection, carried with it some sense of people maybe thinking perhaps you were not as intelligent as you might be. And he was very careful to want to kind of eliminate that before it started with us when we were kids.
Makes sense to me. Yeah. So are you you're originally from the Chicago area then?
Yeah, I grew up actually about a half hour from where I live now, which is where my parents still live in the same house. And we lived then about 10 minutes outside the city. And now I'm about 30 minutes outside the city. And yeah, I've never lived in any other area. I've moved from suburb around here, but this is home. And although we've traveled a lot and I love a lot of other cities, at this point in my life, I can't imagine living anywhere else. I think it kind of has everything that you want in a city without being overwhelming. I think I remember feeling overwhelmed the first time I went to New York.
I could see that. I felt that way too. My first visits to New York, though, were in Manhattan and as part of tour groups. I grew up 3.5 hours from New York City. So, and I went to Manhattan and I hated New York City. And a few years ago, I went with my wife and we got out of Manhattan into Brooklyn, into Queens. And that's when I fell in love with the city.
I've heard that from a lot of people who we know that lived there for a while or who have visited there many times, that if you're only seeing Manhattan, you're really not seeing the city. But I think the only time I was ever there was for my husband to run the marathon. And so we were only there for 4 or 5 days, maybe max. And, I would like to go back and maybe do a little exploring there.
I think New York City and New Orleans have a very strange connection, and I've said this before. What those two cities do is when you visit, yeah, you pay hotel tax, you pay all the taxes and everything, but they take something else from you. They take a piece of your heart, and they say, we're going to hold on to this. You're going to come back for it.
That's interesting. I feel that way about New Orleans. We've been to New Orleans several times.
Yeah, New Orleans has that ability.
It does have a kind of a little, it's a little mystical quality to it, I guess you would say. Although I'm pretty sure I remember hearing you tell me that people always ask me, why in the world do you guys like going to New Orleans? You don't drink. And you don't drink it either, correct?
No, I don't.
Yeah, so I mean, I think that's an interesting, you know, some people just associate it with just Mardi Gras and partying and that kind of thing. And so I think there's so much more to it that I think that's always an interesting reaction from people. Like, why are you going there?
Because the Café du Mans is like one of the best cafes in the whole damn country.
And there's music everywhere and beautiful buildings and beautiful people and great food and many other reasons to go other than alcohol, which you can pretty much get anywhere.
Yeah, you have a drink in Memphis, it's the same as it is in New Orleans. It's the same as in... The only difference is the prices and the strength. That's it.
True.
So I'm curious now, because you are a writer who doesn't drink. I'm a writer who doesn't drink. What is the reason for why we don't do it?
I haven't... The funny thing that is, I don't think I've been a drinker since I legally could drink. Most of my drinking was done in high school. I think at one point in college, if I can remember correctly, first of all, I don't really like the taste of hard liquor at all. Like if someone puts it in like my dessert, it's like I'm a little kid like trying to like brush it off my tongue. Like, and I'm not really a big fan of, never was a big fan of the way wine tasted either. I do like beer. I do like the way beer tastes. But I think it was early in college. I had been really ill and was on some heavy-duty antibiotic and went out, I think it was for New Year's Eve, with friends who were older than I was. And I remember my father and saying, you really shouldn't drink, taking that medicine. I know you're probably going to try and drink. Please don't do that. And so I didn't. And I watched everybody around me get progressively stupider and meaner as the night went on. And then I had to try and get home in a car with those people. And I think that was step one of my saying, I don't really know if I want to do this. And then step two was when I met my husband in college. He didn't drink. For lots of reasons. He was an athlete and different things. And so when we were together, which was all the time, pretty quickly, it wasn't a part of what we did. And it just never has become a part of what we do. We don't care if other people drink. We serve people drinks when they come to our home. I also am a little bit of a control freak. So I don't like something that's going to take away my control over my behavior. I guess
that's why I've never actually done anything other than what are considered legal drugs. I never liked the idea of being out of control of my own faculties like that.
I think it's a scary thing. And like I said, I think watching it as an observer and that in that one circumstance was one of the reasons. Plus one bonus, how much money do we save when we go out?
That's a good point.
I mean, because the bartender will give me a Diet Coke all night long, and I'll pay for one.
Or maybe, yeah, I've had that experience too. I'll go and get that, or now I've started going to, say, get a club soda with lime in it.
Right.
Or something. And the bartender's like, oh, okay, and yeah, I'm the DD tonight.
Yep.
And they're like, oh, okay, no problem here. You know,
I love that you go with them, because they always have a DD.
They do, but they do call upon me to do that, and I've said that's my job then, okay?
I can be amused sometimes by the way that my friends change when they've had a little bit too much to drink, but most of the time it's just...
Part of it is drunk time. Drunk time works different than sober time. So you say, okay, we'll do this in 15 minutes... And a sober person can note when 15 minutes has passed, but the drunk person's like, oh, no, we'll do it in 5 more minutes, and a half hour goes by.
That's true. It's hard to keep things on track when you are on track and everybody else is not.
It's just, it's a different world when you're sober all the time dealing with it.
It is. And I guess, and I would say the same thing. Like, I have, you know, nothing against my friends who, and to be fair, you know, and a lot of my friends that I work with, my colleagues, are probably closer to your age, in their 30s. A lot of them have young kids. So when they get to go out, they go out, because this is not something that they get to do as often as perhaps they used to. And so I think that there's some element of freedom and being unencumbered that's involved in that for them. That's kind of fun to watch.
And I will be honest, sometimes I'm envious because I miss it. I miss good beer. You know, I loved the taste. I loved the taste of it. I enjoyed it. But, you know, I had to give it all up and for medical reasons. And so I do miss it sometimes when I'm out. I'm like, really wish I could have that.
Sometimes it's awkward just to be the person that's not drinking. So, you know, people that know me now know that I don't drink, and that's not an issue, obviously. But, you know, when you're at a party or an event or something where someone doesn't know you and they just keep kind of pushing a drink on you, you know, at some point you want to just, like, I think I actually might have done this in a restaurant once, just whipped out the, like, the guilt trip lie. Like, listen, I'm an alcoholic. Quit making me try and drink. Now, I shouldn't be using someone's disease as a lie to get someone to leave me alone, but it works.
It does.
All right, this is getting very heavy. Let's talk about something else. Like,
all right,
Star Wars or something.
What was that?
Star Wars.
Okay, what about it?
God, I love Star Wars.
I will tell you that right now, just by coincidence, I am currently wearing my Millennium Falcon blueprint t-shirt.
Nice. I love Star Wars, and I feel very privileged to have had a son that I could get it. My son just happened to be about 5 when the prequel trilogies started.
Okay, I'm going to stop you right there, Donna, right now, because I have a very important question for you.
Yes.
You're a parent.
I am.
A Star Wars fan. Did you show him the original trilogy or the prequels first?
Oh, God, the original trilogy.
Thank you.
Why in the world would you do it any other way?
Why would you spoil the child from what we experienced at the end of Empire?
You would. That's ridiculous. Anybody that watches them with their kids from 1 to 6 is useless, in my opinion. No, I have raised a child who is much more of a Star Wars fanatic than I am, who asked for the original, if I could find copies of the original 3 movies on DVD before they were remastered, because he throws a hissy fit if he sees on TV or something the remastered version where they take out the original Anakin Skywalker and put in Hayden Christensen. Just makes his blood boil.
For Christmas last year, my birthday, my wife got me the DVD set finally. You know, I say finally, not like she finally got it for me. No, we finally got one. I finally got it because I wanted the special edition because I thought I was insane for a long time. I vaguely remembered being like a 5 or 6 year old and there being a special hosted by Lando about the monsters in Jedi. And I thought I was crazy for about 25 years. And then they said, oh, it's going to be on the Blu-ray DVD set. And I was like, I must get that.
Okay, I'm not crazy.
But I didn't give up. I got rid of my prequel trilogy on DVD, but I didn't want to give up my original trilogy because it was the special double DVD edition with special edition, original theatrical cut.
Yep.
I said, I won't give those up. My wife's like, well, it's redundant. I said,
he was obsessed when he was a little boy. First, we had the 3 videos, you know, the original 3, which is where he started. And then, like I said, I think he was 5 or 6 when episode 1 came out. And so he got to experience that 3 film arc waiting for them to come out in the theater, you know, kind of like we did, which was cool. Even though they were, you know, in my opinion, you know, inferior movies to the first 3. Very excited to see what J.J. Abrams does with the new one.
I'm liking what I'm seeing so far. I've got cautious optimism.
That's probably how I would state it as well. I really do like pretty much everything J.J. Abrams does. So I have faith that he will, he won't disappoint. But I'm curious to see what happens. I'm looking forward to that coming out. And I think the other thing that's so great about Star Wars is that it's kind of a conglomeration of, you know, action movie, fantasy movie, and kind of these archetypal, almost Shakespearean emotions and experiences.
Combined with bad dialogue, unfortunately.
Yes, but, you know, I don't know, I can live with that. I mean, that's I had this very strange, serendipitous moment a couple years ago. I also love Shakespeare, and Chicago has a wonderful Shakespeare theater called the Chicago Shakespeare Theater, duh, that we hope try to go to almost all the shows. And a couple years ago, I got the flyer for the next performance. The next that was going to run was, and I always say his name wrong, but the actor who played the Emperor,
Ian McDiarmid.
McDiarmid was going to be at Chicago Shakespeare doing Timon of Athens.
Ooh.
So it's like my two big nerd universes were coming together in one glorious play. And my students usually by the spring know me well enough to know that Shakespeare and Star Wars are kind of two things that I love. And when I told my kids, I'm going to the Shakespeare Theater and I'm going to see Emperor Palpatine play Timon of Athens. And the kid said, is your head going to like nerd explode when you get in there? And I said, it might. It just might. It was like a great, great experience. But think about it. You've got both Shakespeare and Star Wars. You know,
well, they just released that book of If a New Hope was written by Shakespeare.
Read it.
I forget who published it, but I've been seeing like some references of it. They rewrote the text of A New Hope as if it were Shakespeare.
Yeah, it's interesting and it's clever.
But it's along the lines of Pride and Prejudice with zombies. It's like, okay, huh, clever.
Yeah, I mean it was clever, but it didn't, in my opinion, didn't quite rise to the level of either one of its source materials. Which I don't know how you possibly could, but there's so many parallels. I mean, what's, you know, Star Wars is basically about the emotional implications of political ambition and war, and most of Shakespeare is about that. You know,
the prequels especially.
Yes,
are that way.
And you've got you've got major characters who are strangely having inappropriate feelings for their female family members. You know, in both Shakespeare and Star Wars, and there's all kinds of strange parallels that are cool.
I hadn't really thought of that.
Yeah.
No, I'm cautiously optimistic about Abrams here from what I've been seeing from what he's been leaking from the set. And although I had my issues with Star Trek Into Darkness, very bad issues with that, but I don't blame Abrams, actually. I blame the screenwriter on that one. But I did read a report. Kevin Smith was allowed to visit the set of Episode 7.
Okay.
And he got to go to the Falcon set. And he's sitting there looking at this, the reconstruction of it on this soundstage. And he's like, I'm blown away. What happened was that he gave a video blog report after the visit, like right outside the studio. Disney, of course, edited it to make sure that he didn't say anything, give away anything. But in the video, he talks about how he's standing there and a stagehand or production assistant comes over and says, okay, you want to come on board? Mm-hmm. And he goes on board and they had reconstructed the entire Falcon from the inside out, the way it was. And apparently Kevin just broke down crying in there and said, you are creating our childhood again. And apparently in the video, he's just sitting there wiping his eyes, which are just red from just crying the whole time of joy. So I'm optimistic. I'm wary, though.
I think you always have to be. You know, there's always a wariness when there's any kind of reboot of anything. And I think, you know, You mentioned Star Trek, and I was not as big of a Trekkie as some people are, but I do enjoy Star Trek. I'm more of a Next Generation girl than an original girl.
Same here.
But I did like both of the new movies. I thought they were entertaining. I thought that, you know, I mean, I didn't pick them apart too much in terms of, I guess, what mythology or whatever, because I don't know that universe as well. But I know that I think Star Wars is, like you said, it's an emotional kind of childhood touch point for a lot of people. I think more so than I guess Star Trek would be. I don't know.
For people of our generation, I think so. It's more Star Wars because obviously you were there probably in 76, 77 when it dropped. I was not there, obviously. My experience, though, I got to experience Jedi at the right moment. I was about 5 years old.
Okay, yep.
So, and the Ewoks, you know, I have my issues now with them, and I love the idea of the Endor Holocaust, that there's absolutely no way that they could have survived. But it was the perfect moment for me. I was one of those kids swept up. I had the toys. I had the bed sheets.
Yep. We had that in our house. We still, we still have the entire collection in the Rubbermaid boxes in the basement for when my son gets a house, and he's saving them. And he's like, you know, someday if I have a kid, they're going to play with my Star Wars toys. And he played with his toys. He didn't do the box.
Same here.
Box thing. I mean, there's no point in having toys if you don't play with them.
No, Seth Green talks about that in a podcast I listened to a while ago, where he's a big Star Wars fan and toy collector, and he has a lot of, you know, expensive figurines and such, but he leaves them in cases that are unlocked so that when people bring their children over, they can just take the toys out and play with them, because his point is, I'm not saving these for money or collecting. These are toys. Play with them. Enjoy them.
Absolutely. That's, I think that whole, you know, idea, that whole mint in box phenomenon is very strange. I mean, I get collecting. I mean, I do like collecting things. But if you're going to collect whatever you're going to collect, if you're going to collect toys, they're toys. Play with them. If you're going to collect autographed books, read them. Take them off the shelf and read them. Don't just stick them in a case and leave them there. I think that's the case with any. I think we place too much value on sometimes what something might be worth to somebody someday, rather than why you have it now.
That's a very good way of looking at it.
Because look at the whole phenomenon with those. What were those stuffed animals called?
The Beanie Babies.
You know, and everybody was collecting them, and oh, you had to leave the tag on, and this one's worth this, and this one's worth that. No, they're not. They're bean bags, and they're worth as much as they are worth to the child that owns them. That's all they're worth.
There was a book published in like 95 or so, the Beanie Baby Collector's Guide, and it was written by two Beanie Baby fans, a family, and they projected the amount values in the 2000s, how much these would be worth. And there's a great website out there last year that did a comparison of these Beanie Babies that were projected to go for $1,000 and what they're currently going for on eBay. And it's like, okay, $1,000? Try $2.
Yeah, they're literally beanbag toys. I mean, the fact that anyone thought they were going to be worth any more than any other stuffed animal, I think, is hilarious. They were perfect, though, for perfect size for when you were traveling with a kid. You know, the kid always wants their comfort thing.
That's a good point. You can't
bring your giant teddy bear everywhere, but the Beanie Babies were good size for that.
I was just at a pet store, and they were giving away a whole bunch of them for free at the front. So I picked up one of a goldfish, and I keep them in my car on my dashboard.
They're cute.
They are.
Doubt about it. I mean, my son had favorites. He had a penguin, I think, that he was trying to remember. I mean, there were two or three that got pretty loved to death. But he didn't really collect them. Like if he liked one because he liked it, you know, his grandmothers or somebody would buy it for him, but it wasn't like he was amassing a collection.
They were toys.
Yeah, we decided early, because we did travel a lot, that if he was going to collect something, it had to be small. So he actually started collecting keychains, which is easy to find pretty much anywhere you travel.
Yeah.
And he has it now. There's like, you know, two or three lanyards full of things that he, you know, they're nice little reflections. They weren't expensive. They were easy to throw in a suitcase. I think sometimes, you know, parents get carried away with wanting their kids to have, you know, something, you know, dramatic and special all the time. And we forget that kids can find, you know, dirt dramatic and special.
When I travel, my collectible is pamphlets from visitor centers and weird little things in hotels like that. I rhetorically analyze and find the strangest, most unusual ones and bring them home. So I have just this small box now of pamphlets.
That's a great idea.
There's one I have of, to give you an example, a science museum. But the way they did the juxtaposition, they have like a 5-year-old girl, and right near her lower waist is the word explore. And I was like, you've got to be kidding me.
That's funny.
I don't think there was anything devious. It was just that's the way they did the layout, and they never realized it.
Yes, that nobody paid attention to. Yeah, I think we started.
It sounded so wrong of me to just go there. I was like, I had to have this one.
I don't know if you've ever seen what's that show with Joel McHale, The Soup?
Yes.
And sometimes they show clips from kids' shows that are so wrong. I mean, taken out of obviously out of their context in talking to kids, that I sometimes wonder how, because obviously adults are putting these shows together, that if they don't maybe do some of those things on purpose. Some of the worst offenders are like the Mickey Mouse cartoons that he shows.
Back in the late 90s, took clips of Mr. Rogers. Mm. And if you take some of the lines that Mr. Rogers is saying out of context, like, do you have a special friend that you bring to bed with you? Mm-hmm. It becomes very disturbing. And this is coming from a guy who, Mr. Rogers is one of my idols of humanity, but... Yeah, there's a lot of adult humor in children's shows.
Yeah, I think there is a lot of adult humor that's intentional, you know, because they know that parents are often watching these things with their kids. But then I think some of this stuff is a little more, I guess, I can't think of the right word, maybe subversive in a way. Like, you know, when you're making something that Mickey Mouse and Goofy are doing sound really sexual to an adult, I mean, that's a little bit weird. I can't remember an example from the show, but I know that I've seen several that we have just been, are you kidding me? That, you know, this is on TV. We were, I don't know, cartoons. I think my son was at a good age for cartoons on Nick. So I got to watch things with him, like, you know, Dexter's Laboratory and, you know, like the Powerpuff Girls and cartoons that I thought were funny that I enjoyed. But I don't know.
No, I know what you're talking about. Just last week at San Diego Comic-Con, the guys who did the original voices of Pinky and the Brain got together to record a script in those voices where the Brain just blows up at Pinky and just curses him out completely. And there's this call for that now of us... boomers and such who grew up Gen X, and now we're in our 20s and our 30s, and we like to look back at it and realize the adultness of these cartoons.
Well, isn't even the, I'm trying to think of the one that was like, it was on the computer, it was a Flash cartoon series, I think is coming back. Strong Bad?
Oh, Homestar Runner.
Homestar Runner, isn't it coming back?
Yes, it is.
I thought so. I thought I heard that.
Rumors are circulating that it'll come back this fall.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny how people get attached to things when they're certain ages as kids and we'll always go back to it in kind of whatever form it's in. Like for cartoons, for me, like, I mean, it'll never be any better than Tom and Jerry, because that's what I grew up with. You know, and the fact that there wasn't any dialogue, I think, is a big part of why that was still attractive to me. because kind of I'm, you know, it's a traditional, you know, obviously chase story every time, but there's a lot of pathos in those characters, I think, because you project onto them because they're not really saying anything.
Plus, so many people love to execute cats in violent manners, you know.
Yeah, well, Tom never died, though.
You know? That's true. He never died.
It's not itchy and scratchy, you know. Tom and Jerry were a little kinder and gentler than that.
If they died, they were shown as angels floating in the clouds, and they were always together. They both died together, and then they caused chaos in the afterlife.
It was very sweet, yes. No, cartoons are... I still watch The Simpsons. I know some people have said they're over it and it's not good anymore.
I gave up after season 10. I got to be honest. Season 10, maybe 11. That's when I stopped watching.
It still has its moments. I think it's, you know, it's getting probably to the end of its, what can be done is new with it. It's probably coming, you know, to the end, but, I do enjoy, I think animated shows are great because they get away with things that a real show couldn't. On the other hand, I think they're like, I am not a fan of Family Guy. I don't know many women actually who are, I don't know. So, I mean, I think animation is an interesting venue for people to explore different things, but I think Family Guy is just, it's all over the place. It's and some of it's like really, that is not a funny thing. I get that you're edgy, but some of it's just a little too over the top for me, I think.
No, I understand. My big problem with Family Guy is what South Park called them out on. Family Guy runs on basically one type of joke, which is the, hey, remember when, insert cultural reference, half of our audience or more won't get.
Yes.
And for me, I've always been a fan of any type of humor where you do multiple levels of it. If you can throw on a fourth wall break combined with wit, combined with some slapstick, combined with satire, I'm going to love you.
Right.
And that's what I loved about the early Simpsons is that they were capable of, you're watching an episode and there'll be something very witty, like Much Ado About Stuffing.
Yeah.
And then there'll be a stupid moment with Ken Brockman where they just turn on the TV and that was the first time she ever drove a car. In other news, and you just go with, you just make up the rest of that news story in your own head.
Right.
And then they'll do a fourth wall break of, you know, cartoons aren't supposed to make sense. And then Homer walks by the TV off outside the house while he's sitting there watching TV.
Right. Are you a South Park fan? You mentioned South Park.
I stopped watching it around season 2 because it had become so popular at that time that it was everywhere.
Yeah.
And then I came back to it years later when it became less popular and I realized that the satire was much more acidic and biting.
Yes. It's completely amped up. That show people could argue also is, you know, infantile and scatological, but yes.
There's a deeper edge to South Park.
There's always a deeper edge, and there's always the satire in that show is incredible, and I just think those guys are so bright, and we went to see Book of Mormon when it was in Chicago, and I mean, they're so good at attacking
with a meaning behind it. Like, there was one a couple of years ago where Cartman got a mobility scooter because of his obesity, and it became this thing of obese people on mobility scooters fighting each other. And there's your kind of gross shock joke, but the subplot is that James Cameron is going into the Marianas Trench because the bar has gone so low, they need to raise the bar of culture again.
That, because that was the one I was just thinking of, because isn't that the one where they have, like, Honey Boo Boo is in it, and, like, Michelle Obama, and they're, like, spaghetti wrestling.
Yep.
And, like, I mean, that episode is insane. And when they had James Cameron going down into the abyss to raise the bar, I mean, I was laughing out loud. I don't laugh out loud at many things on TV or in movies. That's not the way I laugh, I guess, at things. But that particular episode, it's funny that you mentioned that one, was one that I was thinking of recently that was just so sharp. And all the stuff they did about Scientology.
even if it led to Isaac Hayes leaving, but I still reference in some of my classes occasionally the R. Kelly trapped in a closet whole thing with Tom Cruise. And, you know, if I mention R. Kelly, part of my brain hears Ignition Remix. The other part just goes, and then I pull out my gun.
Yeah, that it was really weird to me that about a year or two ago, R. Kelly was all of a sudden like this hip thing again. He was at Pitchfork Festival and like all the college kids were listening to him. And I was like, I didn't get it. Like, how did he get back into the...
It's like, didn't you go away?
Yeah.
Didn't Chappelle, like, get your number? And is it, why are you here?
Yeah, I don't know. I asked my son, I'm like, why? And he was like, I think it's just kind of more like, it's an ironic thing. I'm like, yeah, but if it's an ironic thing, how is he playing? He's headlining Pitchfork. I think it was last year, which, you know, is usually reserved for some pretty great people like, you know, Bjork or mm-hmm. Beck or, you know, Godspeed You Black Emperor. No, not R. Kelly.
No.
So I don't know. He definitely not on my music radar, that's for sure.
I will give you Ignition Remix. I think it's a great, catchy song, but he never appealed to me. Never appealed before the controversy even. I just never saw the appeal for me.
Yeah, I barely know Ignition Remix because I don't really listen to...
I was a DJ when that song was hitting it, so I knew of the song.
I know of a lot of these songs. I try and... I don't listen to a lot of, I guess what you would say, like, pop R&B, I guess. I don't know what you would call that. Music, myself, I try and at least know what my students are listening to as a reference, and though sometimes it kills me what they're listening to. They seem to either be stuck on whatever is very, very popular or stuck back in the 60s where, you know, with classic, what their parents are telling them is classic rock. Very few students in the last few years who have been actually following more current music because they like the music, which is sad to me.
I can see that too. My students are the same way now. They're following it, but with YouTube, Spotify, Pandora, now it's become this point where my students are like, do you know of this band? When 10 years ago, I could probably say, actually, yeah, I've heard of them. Now it's become so fragmented and big that I'm like, no, I have no idea what you're talking about anymore.
Yeah. We're big music fans, and we do go to festivals when we can. Not going to Lollapalooza this weekend, however, because I wasn't crazy about the lineup. But my husband has gone to Coachella the last 3 years with some buddies, and he always starts his posts on Facebook with, for those of you who listen to this kind of music I do, here's the report. For those of you that don't, here's the list of bands that you think I made up, you know, that I saw today. There's so many bands. I know Jimmy Kimmel did this bit 2 years ago, I think, before Coachella. They stood outside the grounds and they made up band names. And they asked people going in, younger people, you know, oh, are you looking forward to seeing? And they made up these ridiculous names like, you know, Sweet Potato Gravy. And because people were afraid to say they hadn't heard of the band, their responses are hysterical. They're like, oh, yeah, I hear they're really good live. I want to catch them for sure. And it's really entertaining to watch people just lie blatantly because they're so afraid of like not being hip enough to know who the band is.
I've gotten to that point in my life where I don't care. You know, in my 20s, I would hide my nerddom. I would try to. And now, I don't care, honestly. My car has, one of its license plates is the Rebel Alliance logo, nice. The Rising Phoenix. And I don't care about hiding it anymore.
Well, I think that there's a point in your life where, you know, hopefully there's a point in everybody's life where what other people think about what you like or don't like should become not of no importance to you. I mean, at some point you have to, you know, be who you are. I think that would be an exhausting life to always be worried about whether you were listening to the right band or wearing the right clothes or liking the right movies or, it's hard enough just to live, to have to worry about, you know, fitting into somebody else's mold of what they want you to be is got to be way too much work than I am willing to take on, I think.
I think it's true for everyone as we get older. We just don't care anymore because there are other more important things to deal with.
True, and that's why I love the kids in my – because, you know, I'm a middle school teacher, so I talk about the most awkward moments of your life when you're trying to figure out, you know, who you are and trying not to be a target. The kids who are just balls out themselves are some of my favorite kids. And they're often, you know, the kids that other kids think they're weird or, you know, they're nerds or whatever. And there are kids out there that even at the age of 12 or 13 are just like, this is who I am. And they're so fun to be around when they're that way.
You have students that just, they don't conform. And it's wonderful to see. And I wonder what their life is like in high school. Because I was that non-conform, and I was second to the bottom on the totem pole.
Yeah, I think that what's, and especially where the area where I work is fairly affluent, and so there is a tendency for kids to want to be like everybody else and fit in and have all the same things and have the same clothes and all this. So I think what's nice to see, though, is that usually those kids, at least in my experience, hopefully, like, they find their people. You know, they're not going to be the homecoming queen, but they find their people and they're, you know, they make their own experience. Now, that doesn't mean that other people maybe don't necessarily treat them poorly, which is unfortunate. And no matter what we do in education, you know, people, you know, schools should do more about bullying or whatever the popular word is. You know, people are people, and they're always going to say and do things that make other people feel bad. And should it, you know, obviously that goes to extremes sometimes. But I think sometimes kids now, though, use that as instead of dealing with an issue, automatically just go to being a victim.
I worry about that, too. I see that a lot on places like Tumblr and such with teenagers and the culture of victimization that's happening on the internet.
Yeah, I mean, part of it is this escalation of scale. So I happened to fill in as dean of students for 6 months a couple years ago, which I couldn't get out of fast enough and get back to the classroom. You know, but I would have kids coming to me, you know, and they would be, you know, falling apart and what is the matter? And you know, I'm being picked on and tell me what's happening. And then when you get to the heart of the matter, it's like, well, what actually happened? Well, she rolled her eyes at me when I sat down at the lunch table, and I was traumatized. And I remember it was right after the tsunami in Japan, and I remember saying to her, I had lost it. I was like, you weren't traumatized. People who live in Japan who lost their families, their homes, their livelihoods, everything they ever owned, they're traumatized. You maybe felt bad when she did that. You need to learn the difference. And I think a lot of kids now don't know the difference.
I wonder about that, the oversensitivity. There was, to get into academia a little bit, I forget the college offhand that started saying that what we need to do is on our syllabuses put in trigger warnings, an explanation of that. And I've been thinking about it in terms of my own class. I teach literature, and I don't teach that literature is happy, fluffy bunnies running around in the woods.
Well, most literature isn't.
No, real good literature, in my opinion, has to deal with topics like poverty, racism, homophobia, drug abuse, sexual assault. It has to deal with these things and confront them. And I wonder how to reconcile that, because there will be some students. I teach some veterans, and when I teach Tim O'Brien the things they carried, the first chapter, I've had some of those veterans come up to me and say, that was a really difficult read because it brought back a lot of memories, both good and bad.
Right.
So I wonder about that sensitivity level as a literature professor now. Should I include a paragraph in my syllabus saying that we're going to be facing some things because literature ain't kind? You know, be aware, or what my responsibility is.
I don't know. I think in a way that's a disservice. I mean, because life isn't kind. And if literature is supposed to be a mirror to teach us about life, then you can't put a warning on getting up and leaving your house in the morning, walking down the street. You know, you never know what's going to happen. And if you're always warning, you know, about how somebody might, to me, that almost is like saying, oh, you're going to have a reaction to this. Why don't we wait and see what the reaction is? I don't know. I mean, I do teach some books that, I mean, I teach To Kill a Mockingbird. When I taught eighth grade, there's a semester of eighth grade that the teachers call the dark time, where it's they teach night and they teach a lot of Holocaust literature, and the kids are, when they're done, the kids are like, can we read like a story with a fairy in it or something? But that's also usually when they're the most deeply affected by what they're reading, and at that age it's not easy to affect a kid with a book because they're so used to consuming action series books. Not that I complain that they're reading, but you know, everything now is a trilogy, you know, mm-hmm. that's written for young adults. And it's all, you know, they're all dystopias, or someone's, you know, in danger or whatever. And I like a lot of those books, but they don't on their own choose things that have these issues in them. And so when they're confronted with them, they are usually very deeply impacted by them, which is what you want to see as a teacher of literature.
I agree. I love it when my students walk away from a piece and they've confronted something. They may not know what they've confronted, but they've found some kind of emotional resonance, and they've confronted something that they may have always had a hatred toward it, but they never had the verbal or the words, the language in place to be able to say, that's what I'm against.
Mm-hmm.
I taught Patricia Lockwood last year, her poem Rape Joke. Right. And I had a couple of students read it and go, yeah, this is what needs to be attacked out there. This is bullshit that's happening. And they finally found the verbiage to say, what the hell? Let's go after this. And it sounds weird when I say that. It sounds like they're going against Patricia. No, on her defense, and saying the rape culture needs to be attacked. The patriarchy needs to be looked at. And it's beautiful to watch that when they suddenly find that language and that anger, that fire in them.
It gives them, I like the way you said that, you know, it gives them the voice for something they didn't know how to address to begin with. I think that's a really great way to say it, which is why I wish that more middle schools and high schools would use things like Patricia's poem, or at least contemporary poetry, to get at some of the issues that, because you can't always read. I remember, part of the problem, I think, I'm going in five directions here.
Okay.
Part of the problem, I think, with when you're teaching something that's considered to be, I guess, controversial, is that if you put the warning on it, so I'm thinking of an experience I had my son's sophomore year in high school, and went to the curriculum night or whatever it's called, and the English teacher said, I've decided to teach The Kite Runner this year. And then I know most of you have probably read it. And she goes, you raise your hand if you've read The Kite Runner. At that point, it had been a bestseller for a couple of years, and the movie, I think, was already out. And my husband and I were the only people that raised our hands in the room. And so now this teacher has to, because she was going to kind of go, well, I'm sure you're aware that there are some mature scenes in the book, but I'm think it's important for the kids to read and they can handle them. Well, now she had to backpedal and talk about with several, you know, kind of give that open call, like, well, there is some material in the book that some people might find to be mature. Please, you know, email me or talk to me tonight if you think you would like to know what those are or have concerns. Well, as a teacher, you know how that blows up.
Yeah.
I mean, it ended up fine, and she taught the book, and everybody kind of signed off on it, which is what she had to have people do. But I think with kids who are in middle school and high school, having all still that parental element to deal with is sometimes the more difficult part than the kids. The kids are okay with it. The kids can handle it. I mean, what they see on the internet or whatever they're watching every day is certainly, you know, they're exposed to more than their parents think they are. I had one, I think it was somebody's grandmother one year, go to the principal and complain that I was teaching my class about rape. And that's when we were reading Mockingbird. And I got called into the office. It was all serious. And I said, we've been teaching this book here for 30 years. And he talked to the person again, and she didn't know the book. She had no familiarity with the book. So when her daughter wanted to talk about the book with her, all she got out of the entire conversation was that there was a rape in the book.
I haven't dealt with that precisely, but I can see where you come from. I try to stave it off. On the first day of my classes, I tell all my students, listen, I'm going to swear. That's just how I am. I'm a New Yorker. And when it comes to literature, I said, look, we're going to be dealing, it ain't going to be pretty. You're all adults here. You can handle it.
Yeah. I think that's the difference is, you know, you're in a situation where you are dealing with adults. And I'm dealing with a 12-year-old, you know.
Yeah.
I would get fired if I swore.
I understand.
So, well,
and I have nothing but ultimate respect for you for teaching K-12 because I know how it is.
I really do like it. I mean, I started my career with the really little ones in kindergarten and first grade. And I couldn't do that now. I don't have that kind of patience anymore. And I think a wee bit too sarcastic to have ever been successful doing that for any length of time. But I've been a middle school teacher for 25 years now. And, partially it's great because I kind of most of the time act like I'm 12. So that is helpful. But it's challenging, but people always say, oh my goodness, you teach middle school. That must be awful. And it actually isn't, because I think, like you said, in high school, there's this kind of sullenness or, either that on the other end, they've kind of, I'm an adult now, kind of know-it-allness. But in middle school, there's still this weird combination of, like, little kid who gets, like, super excited about a sticker on their paper, but, you know, getting to be that more mature teenager, and just kind of these bundles of raging hormones that are completely unpredictable, and which makes them exhausting sometimes. But really fun.
Yeah, they're being pulled in so many different directions, socially, but biologically, but psychologically, but culturally. It's got to be an amazing. You're looking at little mutants at that age.
Absolutely, that's a good way to describe it. And even the differences between we have a 6, 7, 8 school, from when they come in as sixth graders to when they leave as eighth graders. That every year is just a completely different animal. And I haven't taught sixth grade in a long time, but taught eighth grade for many years and now have been in seventh grade for 6 or 7. And just the move from eighth grade to seventh grade was like going into a completely new universe in terms of how the kids handle themselves and the kinds of things that they worry about and the ways that they behave. And but they're fun and they're people, you know, they get things, they, you know, they I think that's why I like middle school as opposed to when I was teaching in elementary school. You know, elementary school is a little bit more, you know, kids are a little more at that age, you know, say K to three, pretty literal. And, you know, you have to be very, very, very gentle with them. Where in middle school, you can be a little bit more sarcastic and kind of come back at them when they come at you, and it becomes part of the game and makes it kind of an interesting chess match every day.
I could see that. So we are almost out of time.
We are. That went faster than I thought it would. I was all worried about having anything to talk about.
Well, you know, the moment you bring up Star Wars, it's off to the races.
There you go. That took us in a good direction, I think. We were getting a little heavy there at the beginning, so we needed to light things up a little bit.
Sometimes it happens on the show. We get a little heavy. Sometimes we go a little light. And who knows where the conversation goes?
It's nice that it got to meander the way it did. It's nice to have someone who's so easy to talk to as well.
I've just got a little list of just, you know, eating on vacations, travel, Star Wars, collectibles, cartoons, the culture of victimization. We're all over the place. And there are so many questions that we didn't ask. Like, I didn't even get the chance then to ask you, what are the things that you collect? You know, what cartoons do you really dig on in the past? Things like that.
Well, that could be another whole hour.
It probably could be. I mean, we just scratched the surface, I think, when it comes to South Park. You know, we didn't get to talk about the Great Expectations episode that a lot of people hate, but us English people love.
Yep. Well, this is why this kind of a conversation is such a wonderful thing, because unfortunately, people don't sit down and have a conversation for an hour anymore and let it meander, usually, which is unfortunate.
Especially when they find out their guest is like a writer or science, immediately they want to talk about, so tell us about your most recent book, what work do you have coming up, and tell us about your writing style. I'm more interested in finding out, okay, so what are your thoughts about episode 7 coming here?
Well, it's much more interesting, I think. I think at some point, every writer interview, there's only so many things you can say, you know, about your writing, or you end up giving kind of a stock response that you have crafted in your head for when people ask you that question. This is definitely much more interesting. We didn't even go into music, and I know we're both music lovers too. So that
was on my hit list. I had made a mental note of, wait, you said that you're a huge music collector and listener and concert goer, and I scare people with, you know, the best compliment I ever received was, Scott, you have forgotten more songs than I'll ever remember.
Yeah, I actually used to win money in college by betting that I would know a certain percentage of the lyrics to the next song that would come on the radio. Yeah, I think there are some that, I mean, they're my favorite, obviously. Well, your favorites, you're going to know those always. But it'd be weird, like, how much I can remember of some pop song from the 70s, you know, that was on the radio all the time when I was a kid. You know, if you start me, you know, I could probably go through the whole, like, oh, The Night Chicago Died by Paper Lace without missing a beat. I have a kind of a weird lyric thing in my head like that.
It was weird because I was actually going to bring that up when you mentioned your father in the South Side of Chicago. I was actually going to start singing that.
And he was a cop.
Exactly. It was in my head immediately. I thought of it. Paper Lace, 1977, I believe it was.
Yep.
I think that's the year. I'd have to double check on that one.
It might be a little earlier than that, I think.
It might have.
Still in elementary school. I don't think I was in high school yet.
Yeah, I want to say 75 to 77, somewhere in there. The sound fits right in that range.
I'm going to guess probably closer to 75.
Let us go. We're doing this on a digital connection. Why am I not looking at the internet?
That's true.
Paper Lace, The Night Chicago Died. Let's find out where approximately
74.
74.
Ah, look at that.
So now, there you go.
Yeah, I do love music, and I have my favorites, but my favorites are all over the map. So
same here. I scare people with my Christmas music knowledge. That seems to be my area of expertise.
Now, I can't say that I have Christmas music knowledge, I'm afraid to say. I think I remember when I was a kid, my mom had some Elvis Christmas album that was like the go-to in the house. Yeah. Beyond that, I think that's pretty much. I mean, that's the standards, kind of, you know, but other than that.
Yeah, I'll have to get into it sometime on this podcast eventually, but yeah, that's what actually turned me off to Christmas music was the standards that radio was forcing at me. I was like, there has to be more out there. And so began my 10-year quest now of finding the most amazing, wonderful Christmas music that is not played on radio.
So now we can bring this full circle here. Now, do you have that whole Star Wars Christmas?
I do not. But I have a couple of the tracks from it because, fascinating old fact that you may know, on one of the tracks on the Star Wars Christmas in the Stars album, the vocalist is the first recorded, the first recording of a young John Bon Jovi.
That I did not know. My son will love that fact. I'm going to lay that on him today.
I'm going to pull it up right now just to make sure I know the song. Bon Jovi. Yeah. It's, he was working as a janitor at the time. And, yeah, the first professional recording of, where is he on here? Oh, thank you, Wikipedia, for your knowledge of everything in the world. But, yeah, it's his first one on R2-D2, We Wish You a Merry Christmas.
Nice.
Yep.
That is excellent.
He was sweeping floors at the time, and they said, hey, do you want to go on the record? And he's like, okay, I'm a decent singer. So, yeah, it's his first one. And you can pull it up on YouTube and listen to the song, and it is an atrocity. The whole album, in my opinion, is an atrocity.
That's why I asked if you had it in your collection.
I did it one time, and I think I got rid of it out of my collection because I was just like, I can't deal with this.
I think at some point we found it at the library or something when my son was little, and I think that was about all we were with.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, 2 weeks with that is enough.
It's like I can't watch the Star Wars Holiday Special. I've tried. The only time I could sit through any part of it was watching the Riff Trax version online.
Okay, that might be entertaining. But yeah, I think I don't know.
The pain is too much.
Cheapens the whole thing.
Yeah, life day my ass. Sorry, you know. I can't deal with that. Chewbacca's family and the weird grandfather having the sexual revelation over a dancing human holograph. I just couldn't deal with it.
It's way too weird for me.
No. I don't know. So anyway, but let me, before we go, what do you got working on the pipe now? What's coming down the line from the world of Donna in terms of writing and such? Anything you want to promote?
Well, I very luckily had Sundress agree to take on my second book. For 2016. So I am still, we're in the fiddling stages still with that manuscript, but that is an exciting thing. And
how can folks find you on the net?
I have a website, which is just my name, donnavoyer.com, V-O-R-R-E-Y-E-R. And I also blog, which this summer way too infrequently, but usually much more frequently, at my initials, which is DJ Voyer at WordPress. And you can pretty much easily Google me and find those things as well. I also have a project I'm working on with an artist that isn't quite to the point where I can give all the details yet, but suffice it to say that I'm super excited about it. And it involves the mystery dolphins that you might have seen come up in conversation on Facebook. Otherwise I'm just always trying to draft as much new work as possible. When I'm teaching during the school year, it's pretty difficult for me to have the focus to create new work. So I do a lot of revision work during the school year, and I'm actually just finishing today converting my son's bedroom into a guest room / writing room for myself. So now I will have a space in the house that is just mine for writing.
It's got to hurt him a little bit.
It does. I think it hurt me more than it hurt him, quite frankly. You know, he's all settled in his new apartment, and he had very specific instructions about how everything had to be taken down because he hadn't cleaned it out yet, but I sent him a picture of, you know, the paint job, and he approved. So
fair enough.
He'll still at least feel like he's welcome when he comes home.
Oh, that's good. Donna, it has been a pleasure talking with you. This has been a great hour.
I had a lot of fun. Thank you very much.
Well, we'll have to have you back sometime, and then we can just go at each other in music and scare everybody.
That would be awesome. I would enjoy that.
We'll go down the list. We'll have to figure out. And yeah, definitely. So it's been great talking to you. Take care.
Take care as well. And hopefully I will actually get to meet you in person sometime soon.
Hopefully indeed. All right. Take care of yourself and have a good day.
You too. Goodbye.
The SAFTAcast is a production of the Sundress Academy for the Arts. For episodes and more, visit SAFTAcast.com. Until we talk again, this is your host, Scott C., signing off.